Hey, this is Chris Atwood of The Alternative on 95.9 WATD. We are delighted to have with us on the show tonight, David Schelzel, who is the lead singer of the band from the 80s, the 90s, and today known as The Ocean Blue. David, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Take us back to when you're in high school. It's, early, mid 80s. You guys are in Hershey, Pennsylvania area. What was the spark that said, hey, let's get our, this band together? What was that spark that just said, we want to create a band? And what was it like being high school students deciding to do that?
You know, I think the spark was the music that we began to listen to around that time and our shared love of it and everything about it. You know, the music itself, being in a band, thinking about things artistically and conceptually. It wasn't like Central Pennsylvania was a hotbed of innovative music. We didn't go see bands. I mean, we were kids. There were no real places where we could go see music. It was all what we heard, what we saw on MTV, what we heard on college radio, and that wasn't even that prominent in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So it was just what we were discovering and falling in love with. I mean, some of the early bands that we connected with and inspired us and, our friendship. We were all pals. We were all not part of the in crowd by any stretch. And so music was a real bond.
You mentioned, the music that bonded you all together and the music that you were listening to. What were some of your influences, in the early days of The Ocean Blue?
In the real early days, I think the first band that ever really captured us and we loved what they were about was U2. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about, Joshua Tree, Achtung Baby era. I'm talking like U2's first record and second record and third record. So Boy, October, and War. I think we liked the idealism, the themes that were in the music of that band, but also how they made music. I mean, none of them were particularly overly talented or qualified to be in a band. I mean, Bono is an amazingly gifted singer and Edge. I mean, they're all brilliant musicians, but on one level, for a bunch of guys who were just learning how to play guitar and bass and drums and sing, they were a very accessible band. I mean, if we had fallen in love with Led Zeppelin, we would have been in big trouble trying to play music like that. Particularly early U2, there was a simplicity, an elegant simplicity to that music. We could actually learn it by listening to those recordings and play it. And I fell in love with reverb and ambient guitar sounds pretty early on. The Edge was a huge influence, but also, other guitar players in that vein, Pete Buck from REM and the more sort of jangle side of things, another real influence on my early playing. And I learned a lot just by listening to those guitar players.
When I first heard you guys play, I mean, I think, would have been around 1989. And I was either just finishing, my time in college and as a college DJ or slightly thereafter. And I remember hearing your first album, The Ocean Blue. And I'm thinking, wow, this is a really cool, early Britpop band. I really like this sound. Then I kind of remember reading back then. I'm like, wait a minute, they're not from England. They're from the United States. But for me, you guys definitely had sort of that 4AD record label sound, with the, I'm assuming you had some influences probably from the Cocteau Twins and bands like that as well.
Yeah, that's really true. And it used to bother me. I remember in the late 80s when we got our deal and we released our first record and everybody was thinking we were from England. It used to bother me. Looking back now, it was kind of a silly concern because, when you're from a small town and your only connection to music is the record store or the radio or the MTV, I mean, your influences transcend geography.
Right.
So we just gravitated towards a sort of lyrical, poetic, atmospheric British sound that was popular in the 80s. So yeah, we weren't listening to Tommy Conwell and the Young Rumblers or Bon Jovi or, US bands, maybe apart from like REM or the Talking Heads or something. And the label we went to was mostly, majority of the bands, well, greater than half, we'll say, were English acts. So we were on the same label as the Smiths and Echo and the Bunnymen and Morrissey and Aztec Camera, the Cult. I mean, all these sort of New Order, all these huge British bands that we loved. That was a comfortable home for us, where we were coming from musically.
And musically, you mentioned, the label. The label was Sire Records. And, I look back at, my record collection over the years, and so many of my albums are obviously from Sire Records. Records. But
yes,
related, you know, it's 1989. You guys basically go from high school to scoring a 3-record deal with Sire. You know, The Ocean Blue being the first album in 1989, 1991's, for me, an incredible album, Cerulean, 1993, Beneath the Rhythm and Soul. What was it like for you and the band when you inked that deal? And you guys were relatively young, what, 19, 20, something like that?
Well, on one level, it was incredible. And it's only kind of gotten more incredible in my mind over the years. Mm-hmm. But I think in some ways, we were too naive to realize how fortunate we were. It just kind of seemed like, oh, yeah, on one level, it seemed like, yeah, this is what we want. This is what we're doing. This is the label we want to be on. This is the kind of music we want to make. I had no idea at the time how amazingly fortunate we were. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea the scope of how lucky we were, because there's just so much great music in the world. And relatively speaking, I don't think my music is any better, in many cases a lot worse, than other very deserving music. But yeah, the stars really aligned for us when we were in high school. And we connected with a really good up-and-coming manager in New York that helped make a lot of connections. At least half a dozen labels were interested in the music that we were sending around when we were shopping for our first deal. And so we were able to get a great deal. And it was, in those days, a long-term deal. I mean, to have 3-record firm with options for a lot more really gave us a sense of artistic security to make the kind of records we wanted to for 3 records. And so that was a tremendous privilege. By the way, I don't have any horror stories about being on a major label. I'm sure you talk with a lot of folks that are
sure
upset, and maybe rightfully so, about their experiences. But Sire Records was a great label to be on. We were so supported by the people that ran the label, from the president on down. I mean, Seymour Stein, Howie Klein were tremendous supporters and, frankly, mentors of the band. And we had a lot of great product managers and radio folks along the way that really got behind the records we were making. So I have no complaint about the time that we had with those 3 records. Yeah, quite the opposite. I think they really did a lot of wonderful things for the band.
You know, and again, to remind people of those 3 really great records, initially by the Ocean Blue. In 1989, The Ocean Blue came out, self-titled album. 1991, Cerulean, and 1993, Beneath the Rhythm and Soul, all on Sire Records. When you recorded Cerulean, your second album, is, you know, obviously at the start of a new decade. And I had mentioned, for me, the Britpop sound really came into being probably around 1990, 91. And as we both know, it had a limited amount of time sort of on that musical, you know, spectrum or musical history. But what was it like recording that album? And for those of the listeners that are here in Massachusetts, there's a connection to that album, to this state. Just share a little bit about that with us as well.
Yeah, sure. So we did our first record in England, well, with a British producer named John Porter, who had produced The Smiths and Aztec Camera. He had been in Roxy Music, was just a fantastic producer. And then also another Australian producer who was equally fantastic, worked with NXS and a lot of other Australian artists, and that was tremendous. But with a second record, I was really starting to get into, as you mentioned, the label 4AD. I was really starting to get into a lot of the releases that were coming out on that label. Mm-hmm. That were, you know, slower, more atmospheric, real moody. And I was kind of going through a moody period in my life too. And it just seemed like I wanted to go to someplace more remote, didn't want to go overseas again. And my whole family is from New England, and I've always loved that part of the country. And we had had tremendous success with the first record in Boston and in a lot of New England towns, played a lot of shows there, and it just was a natural. And I think the drummer was dating someone from Boston at the time, and mm-hmm. I think I may have been too. And so that just seemed like a really good area to go. So we did the second record in Western Massachusetts at a studio called Longview Farm. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty well-known studio, probably in an earlier area than we were there. Great, you know, residential farm with a studio in the farmhouse and the barn, and it was awesome. And it was kind of self-produced with our 2 really great engineers on the project. We did some recording and mixing at Bluebird Studio 2 in Concord, and then some mixing in New York City too. So it's very much a record of the part of the world that you're in.
And so the record they're talking about with David Schelzel, from lead singer of The Ocean Blue, is Cerulean, 1991 when it came out. Huge song off of that album, Ballerina Out of Control. What was the story behind that song?
That song has a great story. I had been in Los Angeles for some record company meetings and had gone out one evening with the general manager of Sire Records and one of the folks on staff there. And we had gone out to see this group, Nitzareb.
Oh, yeah. Nitzareb.
They were, it was a really interesting show.
Very industrial.
And yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's like two guys with their shirts off pounding on these steel drums on the stage and lots of LA kids thrashing about on the dance floor. And there was this one woman there who was dressed up as a ballerina. Her attire was all torn up and she would do these ballerina moves, but then also sort of collide into people. And she brushed by us a couple of times and Sandy remarked, oh, she's like a ballerina out of control.
Huh.
And after she said that, I just was sort of standing there watching the whole scene, watching that dancer, the song lyrics kind of came to me. So Sandy was the inspiration. Well, I suppose the ballerina out of control was the inspiration, and the song grew from there.
In 2019, we're going to fast forward. You you came out with your first album in 6 years, Kings and Queens, Knaves and Thieves. What's the inspiration behind the title of the album, and sort of describe that process, you know, coming back into your own studios, you self-recorded this 6 years after your previous album came out.
Yeah. So we're jumping ahead in time quite a bit from, you know, talking about Cerulean to this, that our last record, our most recent record. But there had been a period of time, like you said, 6 years, where we hadn't released anything. All of us had gone through some particularly difficult things in life. That record, even though it's pre-pandemic, it's funny, when I listen to it now, it almost seems prophetic and right, foreshadowing what the whole world went through in 2020 and kind of continues to convulse from. I mean, I just feel like the world came apart 2020 in so many different ways, beginning with the pandemic, but the list goes on of things that were either aftershocks or just happened since that time. And even though that record came out in 2019, right before, I feel like it really kind of fits the times almost more than any other record we've ever done in terms of themes and lyrics and things that are tackled in that song. So the title comes from the title track, Kings and Queens. And you know, it's a classic existential questioning song about meaning of existence and
sure,
how in one level all human beings face the same fate, have to go through this life of suffering and trying to find meaning in a universe that can be very difficult to find meaning.
It was a self-recorded album. You had mentioned in the early days, you know, 3-record deal on Sire, you know, jumped around a couple of other labels over the years. What was the process like for sort of going back into a home studio to put out this really great album, Kings and Queens, Knaves and Thieves from 2019?
It's really interesting. Our career spans some really transformational changes in the way records are made, or the way they're recorded, the way they're distributed, the way they're promoted. And I mean, the two huge changes are recording technology and then also the World Wide Web and distribution and promotion online and streaming music. And before that, just even downloading music as opposed to, you know, buying a CD or a LP. I mean, I'm sitting in my home studio looking around at gear that didn't exist when I started making records. I mean, my guitar is on the wall there. They sure did. And that amplifier over there did. The computer, the gear I have to record didn't. And I can really record and process sound at the same level of fidelity. I have more options about manipulating it than I ever did in the recording studios I worked in. For a fraction of the cost, I can create a comparable record. Still takes time, still takes talent. I mean, garbage in, garbage out. I have to be able to play and write songs, and you have to figure out how to produce and record them. But the tools are amazing. I mean, you know, what would have cost us $500,000 and indeed did back in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, mm-hmm, we can do for less than 10 grand worth of equipment.
What can listeners of the alternative, but also fans of the Ocean Blue, expect on tour?
Our shows these days are very cognizant of the fact that we have fans that have been with us from day one and fans that are more recent, fans that aren't familiar with our new stuff and fans that aren't familiar with our old stuff. We really try to put together a set that, you know, takes into consideration all those things. So we play almost all of the songs that would be familiar to any fan that's been with us from the early days. Mm-hmm. Play a lot off our first 3 records recently, and we'll play this fall a lot off of our most recent record, Kings and Queens, Knaves and Thieves. And we're also, this fall, we're marking the occasion of the reissue of our 4th record, which is a record called See the Ocean Blue. Mm-hmm. It was on PolyGram in 96, I believe. And that's coming out for the first time on vinyl. So we'll have those LPs at the shows and on sale this fall. And so we're going to be playing probably more songs off of that record than we normally do in the set, which is to say, instead of 1 or 2, we might do 3 or 4. Right. Because it's really tricky to craft a set these days when you've got, I don't know, what do we have, 8 records or something,
sure,
of material. You know, there's songs we really enjoy playing live, and I think people really want to hear live. You know, you and I were talking about Ballerina, Out of Control. That's always in the set. But we also try to just, you know, mix it up a little bit too. We usually do a cover you know, in the early days when we were underage and trying to play clubs and colleges, we learned a few covers. It's kind of fun, actually, to play covers these days. So I would say the last few tours we've done, we've always included a cover.
So we're looking forward to here on the alternative, you know, the Ocean Blue coming to the Boston City Winery on September 4th, you know, playing songs across 30 years of many albums, you know, fan favorites as well. Anything that you would like to add about the city of Boston, you know, for the listeners here on the alternative?
You and I were talking earlier, we did our second record in New England, in Massachusetts, and in part in Boston. I love the city of Boston. I've spent a lot of time there. I have family there. And in the early days, Boston was one of the first cities that really embraced the record. I can remember driving to Boston from Hershey for one of our first shows at, I think it was a club called Access, right by yeah. Fenway.
Yeah, yeah.
And hearing our single on the radio as we were driving up for the first time. And, wow. You know, the DJ introducing this as this hot exploding new single, and it was either FNX or WFNX or WBUR, is that right?
Yeah, probably WFNX or the Boston, yeah, but Boston University, BUR FM, possibly WBCN as well, but most likely.
Yeah, all three of those radio stations I remember played our stuff, and I think two were alternative and one was sort of more classic rock, which I thought was great and kind of funny. And, you know, there was just a great reception from folks there. Over the years, we haven't returned to Boston as much as we have wanted to. You know, we can't go on 3-month extensive tours anymore. A lot of the touring we do is in shorter bursts and a lot of flying to and from places.
Sure.
So I'm hoping that, you know, getting back to Boston can be the first of many, you know, happy returns to Boston, because I just love the city so much.
We've been chatting with David Schulzel from the band The Ocean Blue. They're coming to the Boston City Winery on September 4th. So be sure to check them out up close and personal at that venue. David, thanks for coming on to the show.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.